I guess this is history, but why do we pass a bill like this to begin with? I know when the similar question came up in the legislation I was working on in local service roads and trails, the way we solved it there was provided that the money would only be paid out as required to fund either the planning or construction of a project. But this one requires that there's a 20% front-end payment, then monthly payments, or lump sum. And why was it written that way to begin with, since the idea was to fund projects? Maybe it doesn't matter now.
Well, I don't know. I think we passed the bill last year in anticipation of House Bill 60, and it's like you say, it's history now. Apparently, the approach was to give a portion of the money for the planning for the project, and rather than do it on a voucher basis, we did it on a percentage basis. Now, maybe somebody on the Finance Committee remembers it differently. Someone in the back room here, Representative Rogers.
Yeah, the Finance Committee spent about as much time on the bill as I have suggested we spend on this bill, and it was completely rewritten in pre-conference committee, and one of them was acted on quite quickly by the floor.
Do you have a question, Ernie? Pardon me? Okay, we are.
I think I can answer that question. I'm pretty proud of the administrative services and part of the administration. We've been administering the municipal grant. And I think the reason for that 20% advance was realizing that a lot of these projects for which appropriations were made were large projects, which the municipalities could not fund the working capital necessary in lieu of or in advance of receiving payments for it. So that this 20% advance was more a working capital fund that they could draw on so that they wouldn't have to take their own money and spend it before they could then get reimbursed by the state. I have some other comments I'd like to make, though.
Representative Harder.
Well, we would rather this thing around for 2 years a year. But I maintain that if the legislature appropriated money for a specific project, I'll use one in my area, they advanced by nearly $300,000 for that money, and the remainder sits in the field after it. And as far as I'm concerned, I think that money should be appropriated. The day that the budget is filed in the fiscal year, and I think that obligation one of the things we're talking about that I would support is the money should not be used for any other purpose than what we find out of a check that will be able to make the money. In our case, if you don't spend the money right away, whatever it is that you have on it should be used for the project. The reporters to do this, they don't have any surplus money left over, which I'm sure you don't have to
do. Right. Well, that's one of the reasons I wasn't anxious to move the bill out really fast, because I think the whole question ought to be examined, not only with the city's money, but perhaps with the money that the state keeps, too, because that's, in this most case, 80%, and I didn't mean to cut you off there.
I'll tell you what the end result was after the city took over the cost of remodeling and renovation, just to meet the HSA standards, which is a quality control agency that comes around and inspects the cost of the city like that. And it gets to a point where it's a good day and age where it was given between renovation and new construction. That's one of the reasons I've got a bill in that. I think that's one of the kind of problems that we're going to take it out again. But I believe very strongly that if that line item appropriation is approved by the legislature and signed by the governor, it's an obligation of the state to forward the check. And I don't find it right some restrictions in the law that if the appropriation is accumulated for earnings through taking out 2 years or anything like that. It was 50 years for the state person that I wanted to comply with the exemption.
On the new language down there, say earnings from investment and grant money. Now, I don't know if that covers both grant money that has not yet been dispersed by the state or only grant money received by the municipality. If it is intent to apply that to the grant money that's been received by the municipality, then I think we should say that in there. It's only common at that.
Well, I'd like it to apply to the whole grant itself, but I'm not sure on our ability to do that.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, that's another question in that if you appropriate a grant, say $1 million, and the grant's applied for and finally drawn out a year later, and maybe have accumulated 10% earnings in the general fund. We only appropriated $1 million anyway in the first place, so that would be the level of the grant, unless you build some adjusters into our capital improvements program appropriations to make the rest of the thing automatic. I think you could do that. It would be real hard to do, take the average earnings of the general fund and add something there. That would mean that portion of the general fund that was committed to grants, that so would then a portion of the earnings that we currently count as income be disappear off the list.
I think Carney was next.
Well, I like the idea of giving money directly to municipalities, and my only concern would be that any system of audit would be a penalty for using it in a way that was not consistent with the original grant. And then you can come back to the municipality if they use it for something else. And the heck with this driven out through the controlling of the account at the state level.
Right. Chairman, I think that we could only require that the amount given to the municipality, that the earnings from investment of the municipality's money would be valid to dedicate the revenue from money in the treasury.
Seems like it's a key word.
Real problems, and that's exactly what you're doing. We could annually appropriate it, but that's also difficult. I can't think of a way to do it to get around to dedicate the funds.
General Law.
Mr. Chairman, there might be problems in accounting, though, we'd have to lay down through regulation state accounting requirements. As far as I know, there's no uniform system that's used by the municipalities for accounting. So, you know, there might be big arguments over what happened to the earnings or what they really were, depending on how the future accounting system must be directed, a system of accounting for the purpose.
Not only that, but I'll give you an example of what happened to an appropriation that was in my district where they charged 37% overhead cost for a little minor project. And I know we discussed this in the transportation committee today, trying to find out what the minimum, the maximum, and the average of this overhead cost. And, I don't know whether, the problem, I think, is much more serious than this deal of business right now. I think we can probably amend the law to change some of the things that we did in a hurry last year. I'm not very happy with it right now because there are so many problems that we created by this.
I suspect we're going to find ourselves in a position of, or at least possibly find ourselves in a position of making other grants to municipalities this year, and I thought it would be wise to re-examine this whole question before we start doing that. I'd like to adjourn the meeting, because I didn't intend moving the bills out. Pardon me? Oh, most certainly. Got a good prime sponsor there. Yes.
There's one other comment that I would like to make in terms of, I'm glad to see this being addressed, because we've had questions from municipalities. What do we do with our earnings? Can we use them on the project? And although we haven't had any legal basis for saying so, we have been telling them, yes, use these earnings on this particular project.
Well, they have been doing it in my district.
Yeah, well, we'd rather tell them that than say, yeah, go ahead and use it on anything, or we know we have a fight on our hands if we said, no, you can't use it, send it back to us. But the other problem we have run up against was in another section of the municipal grant area last year, where it said that projects constructed with municipal grants would have to be operated and maintained by the municipality. And there have been a few instances, very few, but a few, where there have been projects which the municipality received money to either upgrade or enlarge or something, a facility which had previously been maintained by the state. The municipality has been reluctant to accept that grant money, feeling that they are now going to take upon themselves the responsibility for maintaining a facility that had previously been maintained by the state. And we'd like to see that question.
We'll address this whole issue again. Yeah. Thank you very much. Thanks for your patience in and out. So today with us is Milton Lipton and Richard Kilgore. Those two gentlemen are world-renowned oil consultants and experts. They work for the legislature, and it's my understanding that you have a contract with legislative council on an annual basis. Is that correct? And you've been working for the legislature since 1970?
Since the summer of 1969.
Since 69. That was sort of an oil year for us. So, let's see, yeah. Close. So, I'd like to start by just asking Mr. Lipton and Mr. Kilgore to give us a little bit of background about yourselves, what your business is like, and we know that you consult for the state legislature, and maybe you could tell us who else you consult for, and just generally what sort of a company it is that you have. And I have one real quick question. I'm not sure who your other clients are, and so I suspect that there are times when there are some conflicting interests among clients, and that must be kind of a tricky question for you to handle sometimes. Maybe you could just touch on that too.
Just in immediate response to your question, there are times when there are conflicting interests between our clients. I don't think that the conflicting interests between our clients causes a conflict of interest for us. And if I say something about the nature of our firm, perhaps that would be clear. We are a petroleum economics consulting firm, headquartered in New York, with an office also in London. We're a relatively small firm, and we differ from most consulting firms in that the bulk of the work that we do on a continuing retainer basis for our various clients. We do some special projects outside jobs from time to time, but the bulk of our work is done with clients who have been with us for many, many years. I won't run through a list of our clients, I don't think that serves the purpose, but I can describe the nature of our clients. We work both for companies and for governments, as I say, on a regular routine basis. Among the companies are many large international oil companies, both U.S. and foreign, and also smaller companies. Of particular interest to you, I think, is the fact that we are retained by British Petroleum through their London office. We are retained by the Exxon Corporation, and we are retained by ARCO. We have not, as a matter of fact, had occasion to discuss in any detail their problem in Alaska. We are consultants not only to the Alaskan government, but to other governments. Again, by way of example, to the province of Alberta, to the government of Indonesia. I select those three because of a very interesting comparison. Each one of these three governments superintends the production of approximately 1.5 million barrels of oil a day. And Indonesia has a population of 180 million people and a production of 1.5 million barrels a day. The province of Alberta has a production of about 1.5 million barrels a day with about 2.5 million people. Alaska has the same level of production with a population of somewhat over 400,000. So the affluence of a producing government obviously is not measured just by how much oil they produce. The nature of our relationship with our clients, whether government or company, is that we never undertake a special pleading for any of our clients. We will not represent a corporate client before a court or before an administrative tribunal. We regard our responsibility as giving relatively objective and, we hope, useful judgment, sometimes in support of their position, sometimes in response to their problems, and sometimes as devil's advocate. And so we regard that as our responsibility for the last proposal. Not to try to make decisions for this legislation, but hopefully on the basis of our exposure among corporations and governments, to be able to discern and suggest what the implications are of the alternatives which face the legislature and in which legislative decisions have to be made. If there's anything else which you or your associates would like to know, I should be glad to. All I can say is that we have been, as I said, retained by the Alaskan legislature, actually the Legislative Council, since the summer of 1969. And during that period, have been exposed, I suspect, intimately to virtually all the questions which are before this particular committee, this legislative session, which means that we were in the forefront of the discussions and concerns about the adequacy of your old income tax statute and worked with the legislature on the revisions of income tax. We were involved both in the oil and gas pipe. Incidentally, the gas pipeline situation is something that touches upon our work, not only here in Alaska, but also in terms of Alberta. And certainly the Alpetro case, we met before various of your committees, while the final decision whether or not it is approved by the legislature is a matter of fact.
I was going to ask Mr. Lipton to discuss some of the issues that probably might affect the business of the state of Alaska in regard to revenue projections that we've had several discussions with members of our own staff and members of the administration this year, and we seem to, every time you ask, you get a different answer, and it's not to criticize them, but we all recognize the changing nature of worldwide oil picture. So at any time any of the committee members want to ask questions, please feel free to do so, but I'd ask you to generally discuss to start with the gas pipeline that we are including in our revenue projections, revenues from the, at least from the royalty gas, and there have been some suggestions ever since the idea was first proposed that there may never be a gas pipeline, and perhaps you have some general comments about the gas line and how you see it progressing and what the immediate status of the project is in your opinion.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll be pleased to say what I think are some relevant considerations about the natural gas pipeline. I should say that when one passes comments today, let alone a year ago or 18 months ago, almost inevitably one has to come to grips with the problems of the natural gas pipeline. And if you come to grips with the continuing problems of the natural gas pipeline, these things being repeated also, in a sense, pyramid, it's like a catch-22 case, because the pipeline's problems are partly a reflection of the lack of confidence that people have in its completion or the concerns about the financing of the pipeline. This is by way of a caveat, because what I'm going to say can't be very positive about the prospect for the natural gas pipeline. And we sent to the state of Alaska on May 1980, a memorandum which we entitled Changing Perspectives on the Alaska Highway Natural Gas Pipeline. The gist of that memorandum was that the interests of all parties concerned, excepting only the participants in the pipeline itself, that the interests of Alaska, the interests of Alberta as a province, the interests of the producers, and the interests of the federal government of Canada, all were beginning to change for many reasons, partly because of the delays, partly because of the runoff, of course, but also partly because the circumstances of Canada with respect to its gas supply situation was changing so much. Remember, when the treaty was signed between the United States and Canada, Canada believed that it would not be able to produce enough gas to meet Canada's own requirements unless it could quickly have access to their own Arctic gas. And if they needed their own Arctic gas within a relatively few years, within 5 or 6 years, they wanted a convenient and early and low-cost pipeline by which they could bring their gas to Canadian markets. And to piggyback on the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline means that it would be scaled to carry their gas before they had the continuing discovery that would have made an all-Canadian pipeline necessary. But what's happened in the interim, and partly because of the delays on the natural gas pipeline, is that Canada has made tremendous gas discoveries within Alberta itself. And the gas discoveries within Alberta itself are not only sufficient to meet Canada's projected gas requirements in Canadian markets, but even to provide volumes for export to the United States. So that within Canada, the sense of urgency about an integrated pipeline from Alaska down is much less than it was before. On top of that, the United States, far from being short of gas, has now developed a gas bubble of its own. And as you know, even the contract gas from Canada is being bought at less than the maximum volume by the United States. So that the circumstances of the pipeline originating as a treaty between the United States has changed tremendously. What has not changed is the importance of producing the Prudhoe Bay gas and of finding a proper disposition for that gas from the standpoint of Alaska. Because Alaska is the one party of interest that needs a decision that confirms the production and the disposition of the gas. The finance, you've heard, I'm sure you've heard an awful lot about the financing problems of the pipeline. I don't want to be repetitious. I would only say that with the run-up of costs, there is a series of questions that follow. The one obvious question is if the cost of transporting that gas from Alaska to the lower 48 states gets very, very high, is there going to be sufficient value for that gas at the other end, really, to pay for the gas?
What is it worth now if we, under the current estimates for construction, do you have some figures that might show us what the price of gas would be delivered to Chicago, for instance, and compare that to what some projections for Mexican or other American gas might be?
Let me just say that if one takes a ballpark figure, and I don't have the foggiest notion, really, what the cost of construction of this pipeline is, the last figures which I heard gooted about, and in no sense are they anywhere near definitive, is a figure about $30 billion for an integrated line, give or take $5 billion, which is a hell of a margin of error. But if you talk in terms of numbers such as that, you're ending up with Prudhoe Bay gas being the highest cost gas delivered into the United States at that time. That doesn't mean that it won't find markets. It can be the highest cost gas, and it can still be attractive relative to what incremental crude imports from the Middle East might be at that time. That's a matter of prediction and forecast. But as I said, the two questions that remain unresolved are, one, whether the value will support so high cost of pipeline, and two, even if it does, is the candle worth the burning? In other words, are there other alternatives? If all of the value of the gas, let's take a ballpark figure, let's say $60 is the incremental cost of imported oil at that time. On economic parity, the gas would be worth over $10 per MCF. $10 per MCF, whether you could get it or not in terms of rolling pricing, one doesn't know. But if you're going to use the full value of the oil in competitive markets to cover the cost of transportation and the profit on the pipeline, what is it worth to the gas producer and what is it worth to the state of Alaska if the net back value is very, very low? Now, from the standpoint of the producers who are being importuned to undertake a very considerable part of the entire financing, if they don't have an equity in the line, then again, their major concern is what the value of the gas is at the wellhead. And if they have no participation in the pipeline and all of the value is dissipated in covering pipeline costs and profits, they have lost interest in it, which is why in all of their discussions they have to consider a possible equity participation, in the, which is foreclosed by law as of the present time. But for the state of Alaska, you are left basically with a very key, with a key question. What does it avail the state if its economic interest in the gas is dissipated in an extremely high cost, even if the line can't be built? Which means, I'm sorry, please.
Mr. Lipton, I want to state a personal prejudice, and so that you'll understand my question, and then I probably end up asking you a question that's really a political question more than maybe than an economic one, and if that's the case, why you just answer what a part of it can't. The prejudice, of course, I was strongly opposed to the location, the choice of line. I wanted an all-Alaska line, and I think for obvious reasons. There has been talk, because of the financing problems of Alaska getting involved in the financing, I'm bitterly opposed to that. My argument was, if the federal government then decides where the line wants to go, and that's one where it wants to go, they want it to go, and they need financing, let them finance it. I wanted the line in Alaska. My question would be simply this, and I've had doubts for a long time, and not based on your expertise and knowledge, but I've always had a gut feeling that we had many problems before we'd ever build a gas line through Canada. What I want to know, is this an opportune time for somebody that feels like I do to start making an effort to reopen the possibility, a reconsideration of the possibility of an all-Alaska line, and is it economically feasible? I wouldn't object to seeing Alaskan dollars invested in an all-Alaska line if I thought, you know, we were going to benefit, but I've never felt that the decision on the line that's chosen had anything to do with benefit for Alaskans or any consideration for benefit for Alaskans.
Well, Representative Freeman, you will remember that when we were asked to address ourselves to the question of possible Alaskan support for the present natural gas pipeline, specifically the proposition that the state float tax-free revenue bonds in the amount of $1 billion, convertible to what was then defined as equity-type participation, and provide out of the state treasury $500 million in direct loans to the pipeline. We suggested to the state that it was a premature decision to be taken, that the state should not be the party who becomes the first lender until all the other terms of financing were known, and I hate to think where the state would be today if they had actually committed themselves to $1.5 billion of support. But the time will come, as I said before, there is no party of interest out there that is as keenly concerned to see that the gas gets produced and find disposition than Alaska. If the producers are able to obtain a participation in the pipeline and can earn profit on the investment in the pipeline, this is at least some offset to to what they may be losing in the low relative value of the gift. The state gets nothing out of that. And yet, it may come to it that the state is said, look, is told, look, we have put together a financing package that looks as though it's going to work. There's a gap in it, and we desperately need the support of the state. At that time, you'll be confronted with a very, very difficult decision. Now, in reply to your specific question, yes, I think not only is it important for the state now to concern itself with alternatives, I think it would be remiss of the state if it did not. Now, what the alternatives are, what we're talking about are not only alternative transportation modes, but we're also talking about alternative ways of disposing of the gas itself. If you're going to move gas as gas, then you're talking about gas pipelines, whether they go through Canada, whether they go through Alaska. If it goes through Alaska, you still have relatively large costs of transportation for the natural gas through the state. The biggest cost overruns that have emerged are those which involve the Alaskan leg of the entire operation. And I'm not sure you get further off first base if you move from all Alaskan lines. Although I accept your premise that you're more inclined to provide state support for all Alaskan lines than the Canadian. But I suggest something else also, that you may be able to contemplate, and whether it is practical or not, it's an alternative equipment to handle it, that you may be able to anticipate that if the natural gas pipeline fails, or even if it doesn't fail as a more attractive alternative, that all of the gas be converted to liquids on the North Slope, that the natural gas liquids be extracted and moved to essentially an oil pipeline to Tidewater. This is what you would like to do in support of a petrochemical operation. But at the same time, that the methane, which otherwise would move through a natural gas pipeline, either through Canada or through Alaska, that the methane be converted to methanol, which is no longer a gas, but which is a petroleum product, and that the methanol and the natural gas liquids together be moved through a petroleum pipeline through Alaska to Tidewater, where the methanol can have various dispositions. Some of the natural gas liquids can be used for petrochemicals or what. But there are alternative transportation modes and dispositions, and it seems to me that the state, as well as some of the producing companies who are obviously looking at those possibilities, that the state should be not wait for another year or 2 years until it's either or, the pipeline isn't going to be built, what do you do then? Or yes, the pipeline can be built, will you put your money into it? Until you have, as a state, considered what alternatives are available to you, rather than simply commit the state funds. Yes, I think this ought to be very high priority on the agenda of both the administration and the legislature, as well, obviously, as of the producing companies. You don't have to be told how to look after them.
Thank you very much. Representative Rogers.
Just following up on the methane-methanol conversion, it seems to me that has some traction in terms of the ability to be able to ship the methanol via quite a number of transportation modes. It might be easy to ship it to rural Alaska. You don't have to worry about the spills. Reduce the environmental hazards. And the big cost is the 25% or 30% of methane you lose in conversion cost. But I haven't, the legislature has never done much on methanol. What would you suggest in the way of studies or in the way of assessing that alternative? What should we do to follow up?
Well, we had actually suggested in the fall of last year, when your joint committee was considering petrochemical projects, that one of the questions that the state put to the people who were competing for the franchise to conduct a feasibility study that one of the things that be included in the feasibility study in cooperation with the producing companies on the North Slope is this question of methanol conversion. I'm not suggesting for a moment that the legislature or the administration go out and hire a bunch of technical experts who go into this. There are alternative methanol processes, they have different costs. But the clue, the key factor, is relatively straightforward, and at least rough estimates can be made by people who are prepared to commit themselves to the problem. You're comparing, in the first instance, the loss in the conversion of methanol as against the gain in cost of transportation. But there's still another factor, and that is because you can move methanol between point A and B cheaper than you can move natural gas between point A and B. But what is added to your equation is what happens to the cost of moving methane from point A to point C, which is in the lower 48 states. And the higher those costs go up, the more this tends to offset the losses in insulation.
In addition, you add a whole bunch of point Bs that you can go to.
Well, that's right. Yeah. Sure. Now, I don't discuss this before House Finance Committee with the idea that this is a proposal which we are making, but I do think that the state would be remiss if finally it has to do a crash study a year and a half or 2 years from now because either the natural gas pipeline collapses for lack of financing, or it may be built, but whether it's built or not is contingent upon what this legislature is prepared to vote in terms of funds. And you ought to know something about your alternatives before you make your final decision as to how you commit your funds. And I would think that particularly with the pivotal nature of the negotiations now over financing and with the producing companies being involved, and with, incidentally, your whole petrochemical feasibility study hinging not just on the feasibility of using natural gas liquids at Tidewater for a petrochemical operation, but whether or not the liquids will be available and at what price. And the price at which the liquids will be available for Alaskan petrochemical operations is not independent of what the cost of transportation on a natural gas pipeline is going to be. Every run-up in the cost of transportation over the natural gas pipeline through Canada increases the attractiveness of natural gas liquids processing in the state of Alaska. Now, these things ought to be looked at simultaneously instead of piece by piece and separate.
So that's one thing that often confuses me is the some of the activities in Alberta, as a matter of fact. And I know the NEB, within the past year or so, allowed that, yes, certain Alberta gas could be exported to the United States for a short period of time. And as a result of that, certain of the pre-build portions of the gas transportation system were begun. And that, I think, added a lot of encouragement and raised the expectations of people in Alaska that the line was certainly going to be built. And I know that Northwest is now doing some work here in Alaska, or some people that actually work as contractors doing work for them. It appears to have an ongoing nature, and it looks like it's sort of trying to come together from both ends there. But now you suggest that there's a great likelihood that it'll never really come to pass. So what is the pre-built sort of a myth?
No. Let me just define the problem. The pre-built, first of all, is not being built under the same terms and conditions under which pre-building was originally conceived. What's being built are transportation facilities which go from Alaska in two directions into gas markets in the United States. Now, before an integrated natural gas pipeline can be built, it requires the Alaskan leg to be built, and it requires a connection through Canada from the Alaskan-Canadian border into Alberta, from which the pre-built section is being constructed. Now, the pre-built is being constructed now on the basis of the authorization for increased exports from Alberta to the United States. Now, the intriguing thing about this is that the pre-built legs of the Canadian line can survive, albeit with some financial problems, if the Alaskan pipeline is never built?
Well, now that assumes that they've got a long enough period of time, greater than 5 years, which I think was the original allowance by the NEB, wasn't it?
Well, the NEB has now extended the period of depreciation to make their economics, to improve their economics. But the important thing, I said they would have greater financial difficulties. There's no question about it. But they can survive, and in due course, there's very little question that Canada will be developing internal sources of gas which can support their own transportation system. They can survive even if uncomfortably and at less than attractive economic prospects without the Alaskan rate. The Alaskan production of natural gas can't survive if there's a gap in the Canadian system. It can't survive if there's a gap in the Canadian system.
Just saying it can or
it cannot. Yeah. It cannot. I think this is one of the problems of financing. If you look into it, you can raise, theoretically, all kinds of debt capital if you reassure on the technical aspects of the line, if in fact there is a sufficient secondary backup for cost overruns, if you get suppliers to commit to enough credit. But everything that you do there itself tends to raise the cost. But what you're left with is the one great uncertainty. That is to say, who is going to be the ultimate carrier of the risk? Because if something happens to stop the completion of the line, but even if the line is completed and something happens to the availability of gas, if there's interruption, whether it's by regulatory or for whatever reason, who is prepared to commit himself to a take-or-pay contract in the effect that the lenders will have a claim for the repayment of their debt capital, even if there's no gas throughput? And when you have these factors, all of these presumably can be solved with problems if there's enough contribution to the whole thing, but it all comes to the cost of the line. Because every time you cope with another uncertainty and you try to shore it up, it raises the cost of the line.
I didn't mean to make the whole meeting on the gas line here, so maybe we ought to move to something else, unless somebody else gets there. Are a couple other questions on the gas line.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one question. I saw I think it was a 60 Minutes or 2020 or one of those type shows. The point of it was there's sort of a scandalous lack of information in the United States about the amount of gas, and that the Gas Deregulation Act or whatever it was that passed a couple of years ago at Carter's behest was really kind of a crazy idea, and a lot of other things, I guess, that the reasons for it were not very well thought out, because there really wasn't a scarcity of gas, and that was the whole point of it. And they went around to parts, states down in the Gulf of Mexico, and talked about the overthrust belt and all sorts of things, and made a pretty good case, but somebody like myself doesn't really know what the real facts are, that there was just a whole lot of gas in the United States. In fact, they were talking about a surplus of gas for 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years, and that had relatively cheap production costs. Would you comment on that? Because that seemed to me, when I saw that, I thought, well, there goes the last pipeline.
There was it depends how you define shortage or surplus of gas. And I'm not trying to be obtuse about this. In the winter, when the United States didn't have enough gas to fill its pipelines, and there was a question, would homes go cold and industry was being shut down, in a sense, we had a surplus of gas. We had a surplus of gas because at that time, we were burning about 60% of all of our gas under boilers. We were very, very low value and use. And if our gas were being directed into high value end uses, we would have a surplus. We would have a surplus of gas. The higher the price of gas goes, the more we tend to cut off low value end uses, and the more we concentrate our gas in the high value end uses. Now, we've developed a temporary bubble, a gas bubble, a temporary surplus, as a result of a combination of factors. When we went to towards the 1978 Natural Gas Policy Act, blanketed intrastate in with interstate,
right.
There was a lot of intrastate gas that was getting very, very good intrastate prices, but where you couldn't market all of it because it was high price. When you commingled it, suddenly this gas became available for interstate, floating interstate commerce. Then we have been finding a lot more gas, there's no question about it. But I wouldn't be concerned somehow that the Prudhoe Bay gas is going to be so much a part of a North American gas surplus that by itself it can't find markets. The question is how, where, under what terms and conditions. Now, one of your problems is the Natural Gas Policy Act of 1978. It set a ceiling price for Prudhoe Bay gas, you remember, $1.46 for MCF at the wellhead, plus escalation, ceiling price, to encompass the cost of gas processing, which is a negative aspect. The pro was, this was the one category of gas that could be rolled in. We don't think the Natural Gas Policy Act of 78 is compatible with a deregulation of crude oil. What we're doing is we're creating an impossible gap between the price at which gas goes until certain categories are decontrolled and what the price of oil is, so that the gas becomes preferable to oil, which may not be so bad if you had enough gas, but also it cuts into our desire to develop coal, because who wants to invest in coal-burning facilities when gas is available cheaper? So we think there's going to be revision. And when it is, two things may happen. On the one hand, the odds are that your Prudhoe Bay gas will get out of wellhead control. But at
the same time, that there's less low-cost gas to roll in to modify the average price or whatever you call that of the Prudhoe gas, there's the average price is going up if they're deregulating.
It's
going to go to the market, you know, whatever the value is on a BTU basis or whatever. Then it's going to go up. So what does that mean?
Well,
I mean, it's sort of opposite thing, isn't it?
I said that there's a question whether the value of the gas will support the cost of the pipeline. Now, there's no question. It may very well. That is to say, with the escalation of oil prices, in the end, that gas is going to be valued not necessarily in competition with Mexican gas or Canadian gas, but if the alternative source of energy is imported oil, this is what creates the value of it. So the question is, one, whether the downstream value will support the cost of the pipeline, and two, is the candle worth the burning? Do you want to commit all of the downstream value just to support the cost and the profits of a pipeline? But in the end, the downstream value will be determined in competition with what is the cost of alternative energy, and at the margin, that's going to be imported oil, which will not be going down or weakening in price.
Thank you.
Nothing to do with the oil with community of the gas line. Can I ask a question? Okay. Well, this has something to do with oil. With the increasing price of oil, as you see, it's going up constantly, and many countries are converting now into coal. Could you comment on the extent of this conversion from oil to coal, and how it affects Alaska's revenues, oil revenues, and if Alaska should enter the coal export market, if so, why? If not, why not?
The rising cost of oil is causing everyone who is able to turn to alternative sources of energy. And for all of the world, coal is one of the alternatives. But the bulk of the coal which can be developed is really in North America. So that there's a limited contribution that coal can make as a substitute for oil in other parts of the world. There is coal in South Africa, there's coal in Australia, there's coal in lots of parts, in India, coal all over the world, but certainly relative to oil, nowhere as prolific as in North America. And, you know, I'm always asked, in, especially in Europe, how coal fits into the U.S. energy prospect. And, you know, the quick answer is that coal is the answer to all of our energy problems in North America, excepting for two things. You can't mine it and you can't burn it. If you could mine it and burn it, and, you know, the balance that has to be struck between the economics and the environmental considerations is a very, very difficult one. I don't think that anything which transpires by way of other energies substituting for oil, or the slowdown in the demand for energy, which take place because of conservation, because of high oil prices, because of economic slowdown around the world, put it all together, that still leaves an increasing demand for oil, which every year presses harder and harder against the world oil reserve. Simply put, there's going to be, over time, for the next decade and beyond, a rising price of crude oil around the world, not only in dollar terms, but in real terms. And this provides tremendous support for the value of Alaskan oil. Secondly, to the extent that you have alternative resources, this pressure worldwide on the availability of energy provides better opportunities for the development of your alternative resources. Now, whether you can develop these alternative resources in a competitive world for export is a difficult problem. It depends upon your cost, transportation. But if you can develop them for internal use and provide better export possibilities for your oil and natural gas, this represents for Alaska, you know, a relatively intelligent and efficient utilization of your total resources. For many countries that have oil, coal, and natural gas, it's almost a sine qua non that you try to use within your country, and I'm now speaking of Alaska as a country, you try to use within your country those energy resources which are most expensive to transport, and to export those energy resources which are least expensive to transport, and to economize on the total availability.
Are you familiar with some of the coal that's by some considered to be easily exportable? Like around Cook Inlet, there's some fields that are some on state land, some on regional corporation land. Most of them leased out to some pretty large corporations. But right now, they aren't mining any coal, with the exception of up the railroad. And I understand they're short-term contract for exporting some coal to Korea right now. Mm-hmm. Using Alaska Railroad going to, I think that Thelma's question was a good one, and I just wondered, I'm not sure you answered whether you thought that Alaska ought to get into the coal export business, or do you think there's a prospect?
If Alaska can get into the coal export business, by all means. If Alaska can use the coal internally, by all means. But you ask me if I'm familiar. I mean, I know of it, but I'm not familiar with it. I think that Canada, for example, is beginning to develop coal resources with Japanese capital investment, specifically for export to Japan. Now, this involves a very considerable railroad haul from Alberta to the West Coast, the development of a coal export port in British Columbia, and then the transportation to Japan. You're relatively close.
Well, if that's whether economic, coal, it seems like ours ought to be.
Yeah, but then it depends on what the cost of your coal is and its quality. That's a tough one. And that's a commercial sort of decision. But I would guess that if not today, tomorrow, if not tomorrow, the day after tomorrow, if you've got prolific coal deposits and the costs are not too high, that they will be exploited.
Most coal is on the North Slope, which makes it tough to get to.
Can I comment, Ben? What you're saying, Ben, is that for purposes of larger revenues for the state, the most practical way of handling our resources would be to use coal internally and to export oil and gas. that is your perception.
As an economic equation. But look, there's more than economics involved in this, and I'm sure the citizens of Alaska don't only think in terms of revenues. One of the other questions is, what happens to the state of Alaska if you burn coal? What is the quality of the coal, and how do you burn coal? A lot of countries would like to export their pollution and not keep it close at home.
Representative Rogers, in turn.
Mr. Chairman, I have several questions. They go around taxation issues, beginning with coal. We've been through over a decade of oil taxation. Questions coming back and forth every year, and I'm wondering if we are developing our coal. What if our coal resource? If there are anything you think we should look at early on in terms of our taxation and leasing policy on coal?
You know, the generalities are easy and they're kind of banal. So I'll skip them. There's a big difference between tax policy and coal and oil. One of the things that you have to worry about in the oil industry, that is every country that's involved in oil production and every government that's involved in taxation of petroleum, is the relationship between the aggregate cost of exploration, including abortive and unsuccessful exploration, and the profits on the successful venture, which has to pay for the whole business, not just the successful venture. Now, you may have very, very high capital costs in coal development, but you don't have the same disproportionality between unsuccessful investment, where everything goes down a dry hole, and the successful project that you have at all. That changes the circumstances. Secondly, you have to know something about, one, the capital cost, and two, the average cost per ton or per BTU of coal development. And until you have some exposure to what's involved and know something about the quality of the coal, to answer the question. I suppose, in a sense, coal is a marginal resource in this country in the same sense that oil was until Prudhoe Bay was discovered. And Prudhoe Bay not only changed the circumstances in terms of Prudhoe Bay, but it changed the circumstances of all other exploration and development everywhere else in Alaska. Until you have the beginnings of coal development, the same thing is true. The first major mining operation is going to involve a fantastic infrastructure for the mining operation, for the transportation operation, and everything else. And after that, you're on a different portion of the development story.
Right. On some other issues, we've got corporate petroleum income taxes and litigation. We have the growing national awareness of Alaska's oil wealth, and we have various proposals starting to float up of perhaps technical adjustments or major substantive changes to Alaska's petroleum tax structure. And I wonder if you could discuss your perspective on number one, perhaps the most pressing issue of petroleum, corporate petroleum income tax litigation, and the outside impressions of Alaska's wealth as it relates to the taxes.
Brian, can I interrupt and just see if there's, I think there might have been a couple quick questions on coal, so we stay on that and then get back to you. Did you have something else on that, Pat?
Yes. I was going to ask you about, you alluded a little bit to the potential problem with the use of coal. I wonder if you could comment on the possibilities of conversion of coal.
Well, and that's an interesting possibility. It's, in many respects, a higher cost operation than the conversion of methane to methanol. As a matter of fact, there's some advantage in sort of a dual process where you do it to both
together,
but in terms of where your coal resources are, and if you're talking about Prudhoe Bay, yes, they don't mesh. I think the problem of balance, if you talk about the environmental costs of mining or burning coal, seems to me that one of the most important developments from outside that affects Alaska is the appreciation in the value of your natural resources, which makes development more possible. But under better terms than might otherwise be contemplated. For example, development in the abstract sort of means, well, let's mine, or let's produce, or let's manufacture. That's development in the abstract. But development in the broader sense has to do with the way in which the economic activity is purposeful and consistent with all the other things that matter to the citizens of Alaska, including environmental protection. Now, with the appreciation and the value of your resources, the balance between other considerations, develop energy, suffer pollution, suffer boom and bust, incur inflationary pressures in the state, you have more time and you've got more value of the resources to commit to development which is consistent with the other things that matter in the state. I think this holds true of coal development too. You don't have to proceed on a crash program the way the state worried about how fast do we get our oil production going so we can meet the projected deficit of the state budget. And the pace of development can be geared with greater concern for everything else that matters to the citizens of the state. So I think that you could probably handle pollution problems here once the value of the resource appreciates beyond what used to be, you know, it's marginal, can we develop it or can't we? So I think you have, in the kind of world which we're looking at for the next 10 years and beyond, you probably have more time and you've got more financial capability to do a proper job than would have been so 10 years ago. I think this is one of the biggest changes that really has affected the future and the perspectives of Alaska. Yeah, let's get on with, let's make haste with deliberate speed.
My question was on the Park Patrol and income tax litigation and on the federal perception or the national perception of Alaska's other work. You, of course, were quite involved in persuading or in making legislators aware of the need for changes in the corporate tax structure, and now 2.5 years later, we're in trouble.
I'll try to answer this question as succinctly as you asked it, not be too long with it. One, you're in litigation for fiscal reasons. You're not just in litigation because the law was an illegal or an unconstitutional law. It was in litigation because of the financial implications. One of the states that filed a brief before the courts contesting the law points out that it asked the Department of Revenue for separate accounting some years ago when they weren't making any profits in Alaska and were being apportioned by the formula and paying taxes on the basis of outside income when they weren't. There's a very practical thing. Your law is what it is because the state was persuaded that the apportionment formula did not do justice to the allocation of income in the state of Alaska. You want to eliminate the litigation and still retain the revenues and go to alternatives, you're not going to avoid the litigation, or at least the issue. Because if you decide that, well, we'll go back to the old statute, but we'll change the apportionment formula this way, that way, and the other way, and the companies are exposed to exactly the same level of increase in their tax liability, they have as good or as bad a case then as they have today. So I don't think you're going to avoid the issue of litigation. I think the paramount problem that you're facing is not the outcome of the law, of the lawsuit. I think it's the overhanging uncertainty which is devastating for the state of Alaska and which is equally devastating for the oil industry. It doesn't matter how the thing is going to come out. The uncertainty for 5 more years and beyond because the state is concerned about the uncertainty, the possible liabilities that will build up if the court decides that your amended income tax law is unconstitutional, is illegal by whatever standards. The state faces all kinds of financial liabilities, and this legislature has got to worry about those financial liabilities for the next 5 years. Nobody's going to have peace of mind. But you know, the industry can't have peace of mind. Because if they lose the suit, to be sure, they've already paid the money, and they're not out of pocket. But suppose they win the suit. Then what? Can you visualize five judges in a majority of opinion deciding judicially, as a point of law, this tax is invalid? Now, what's the next thing that the judge says? He said that. That's a little. What's the next thing that the judge says? What relief for the industry? How are they going to be paid back? Is the state's been improvident? It doesn't have the funds. Can they pay it back in 10 days? Can they pay it back in 30 days? You start negotiations all over again about the financial relief which a court judicially has said is owing to the company. And you've got to negotiate with the company. And can any company believe for a moment that in the course of the negotiation over financial relief, the state of Alaska won't find the alternative which minimizes its financial liability? I think this is a devastating uncertainty for the industry to live under. And if they feel today that somehow exploration and development is inhibited by your tax statute, how in the world can they continue future exploration and development if the whole tax statute is in limbo, the repayment of funds is at issue, and this legislature or the succeeding legislature is coping with the financial problems of the state? I think the biggest problem for both parties is the uncertainty. And I think the incentive must be acute for both parties to avoid the legal issues by themselves. Now, you ask, how does the world outside perceive Alaska? I don't think there's an answer to that. I think different people perceive the circumstances very, very differently. I'll add one other thing. I think that apart from the legal issue, I think the policy, the taxation policy of the state is important. But I think you have to weigh not only the dollars and cents, but if you lose the case and can recover by different means, what the implications are of moving from an income tax with certain implications of where the burden falls to a severance tax, which has an entirely different impact, to possibly a severance tax on net value instead of on gross value, to ad valorem taxation. The whole panoply of taxation to which you might have recourse may have the same implications on the dollar revenues from Prudhoe Bay in any particular fiscal year, but can have very different implications over a long period of time and for exploration and investment prospects in the state.
Well, for the certainty question, that's, as I hear it, is the biggest issue, rather than, because we can always invent a different way to get the same number of dollars, and probably will try several, but is it worthwhile then for us to consider making it quite clear what happens if we lose the lawsuit by, for example, enacting some sort of standby legislation that made it quite clear to everyone exactly what happens if we suffer a mammoth revenue loss or something like that?
Well, I wonder, in the face of a lawsuit, if you want to legislate for all time and for a considerable period of time. I don't imagine. Well, in effect, what you do is if you table alternative legislation and you're able to pass it, what you prove to the industry is that the votes are available in the current legislature to offset a negative effect. The negative effect isn't going to come in any case if the suits are pursued for 4, 5, 6 years. And in a sense, you can't commit the next legislature or the following legislature. I think it depends for the industry to have a sense of what the mood and inclinations of the population in successive legislatures are going to be. I don't know that you prove something very much if you adopt standby legislation at the present time. And I think also it's probably, well, you've got to judge, but is it conducive to settlement and to avoiding the suits to do that? There is a pragmatic matter, and that has to do with the taxation, and there is a very, very sticky part of the tax on tax, the windfall tax. And I think that this is something that the legislature should address itself to. If you do nothing, you're doing something on the windfall tax. The tax that the companies pay on the windfall tax payments to the federal government is an inadvertent tax which they pay. This was not foreseen when the income tax law was passed by the state. It could not have been because it was not a fact and it wasn't facing anybody.
Well, it was foreseen one way, and that we were going to exempt certain deductions and exemptions, and we weren't going to necessarily allow the federal government to decide what the state revenues were going to be. So we were very specific about certain exemptions, and as the federal government created new situations, they weren't going to necessarily affect the state's tax structure.
Well, I know I should have taken a course in how to make friends and influence people. I never did, and I'm going to say the wrong thing, Representative Cotton. But you have always suffered the federal government's deciding for the state what its tax revenues were going to be. When the federal government had price controls on crude oil, that had a vital effect upon the tax revenues of the state of Alaska.
There's nothing mistaken about that.
That's right. When the federal government decided to support operations in Prudhoe Bay by giving entitlements, giving them a world price, but exempting them from entitlement costs, this tended to support the value of Prudhoe Bay production. The federal government has extended certain commitments to the state of Alaska. For example, you can raise your severance tax to a certain level, and the federal government waives windfall profits tax on that. It has exempted everything north of the Arctic Circle from it. Now, when I say that it was inadvertent, what I'm saying is that the state had no way of anticipating at what pace decontrol would take place, and therefore the value of crude oil production would go up. There are different ways in which decontrol could have handled. They could have phased up the controlled oil price over a year and a half and not imposed a windfall profits tax, in which case the Prudhoe Bay realizations at the wellhead would be lower than they are today. So that in a sense, when you wrote the income tax law, the core of which is separate accounting, what you said was the state is entitled, as an alternative to the apportionment formula approach, is entitled to get a clear and close indication on what the gross revenues are of producing operations and what the net profits are after you've defined what the deductions can be. But what you were pointing at was the profitability of producing operations in the state. Inadvertently, what's happened here is that a portion of the gross revenues go to the federal government as a windfall profits tax. But this does not appear in your statute as a deduction. In that respect,
well,
it's inadvertent.
That point is very clear.
Now, what I'm saying is that if nothing is done by the legislature, I think something is done. What is done is what occurred inadvertently now becomes a matter of policy because the issue has been struck. Now, how you resolve that, this is something that has to go through the judgment of the legislature.
Well, I agree with you when you say if the legislature does nothing, they've done something. But it's now, as a matter of fact, up to the legislature to make a decision on it. It hasn't already been made for us. I think I sort of interrupted Representative Rogers' final question.
My final question, Mr. Chairman, was not directly related to the tax issue. It was to go back to the initial coincidence, I suppose, that they've been laid out of Alberta, Indonesia, and Alaska, each producing 1.5 million barrels a day. Can you give us a rough idea of annual revenues from that oil producing the three jurisdictions?
I can describe the differences rather easily. I don't think I'd like to take a crack at the actual aggregate oil revenue. What you have in Indonesia is oil which is valued at the point of export at $35 a barrel. And after costs, the government of Indonesia keeps 85% of the after-cost profitability. The companies get 15% after-cost.
These are the tangible cost of operations.
Yeah. Well, they amortize their, they capitalize a certain cost. They can take they can expense all intangibles relatively quickly. But the key, these are minor points. The key thing I think that is of interest to Mr. Rogers is the way in which this country handles its tax. Now, the difference, of course, is that Indonesia is a nation with one tax regime, and Alaskan operations are a combination of federal and state.
How about Alberta?
There's a greater similarity in the case of Alberta, because Alberta is a province operating where the producers operate under different tax regimes, federal and as you know, at the present time, this is one of the greatest conflicts that faces both the federal and the provincial government. Producers and the province of Alberta operate under appreciably lower wellhead prices than obtained here in Alaska. They still have federal price control in Alberta, and at the present time, the wellhead price after the last authorized price increase for Canadian crude is, I believe, about $18 Canadian a barrel. Yeah, that's $17.75 Canadian dollars, which means in American dollars, it's 15% lower than that. So you have a relatively low price. You have a federal income tax at the resource level, which is about 25%, which is lower than our federal income tax, but which does not allow the expensing of Alberta royalties. So in Canada, you pay federal income tax on the royalty that you pay to the Alberta government. That was a cause of considerable dispute in 1975, and the way it was resolved was by the federal government, which had just then rescinded the expensing of royalties because Alberta had dared raise their royalties so high. Said, okay, we'll keep the expensing of royalties, but we'll reduce our federal income tax to the 25% rate to offset it. So there you are. Alberta has a relatively high royalty level, relatively high. Further, but the Alberta royalty is not the same thing as your royalty. The Alberta royalty is more in the nature of a production or severance tax. And in fact, the Alberta royalty, which is written into leases, is subject to variation. And the producing industry has, since early after World War II, been willing to accept leases, pay bonuses for them, explore and develop in Alberta, even though they were subject to variable royalties. Talk about uncertainty. This was the case.
Huh? How much?
Well, the original royalty was 16 2/3% and changed by orders in council in Alberta, and it's been progressively raised as the value of Alberta oil went up and as the profitability of the industry went up. But you have an entirely different, as you can see, you have an entirely different tax structure. Difficult to estimate, for example, how much out of average Alberta production a company retains, because a lot depends upon the. But the striking difference there is a much lower wellhead value. And with tremendous, the industry and Alberta would like the federal government to bring those prices up towards the world level. much faster. Federal government has been reluctant for a lot of reasons to do so.
Well, you said it's difficult to estimate, but it sure would be interesting if you could. I mean, they were at 16% royalty. What are they now?
Oh, their royalties now, they have variable royalties for new and old oil, as a matter of fact. Can we answer that subsequently? I'd rather not make a stab out of it, unless you know it, Dick, offhand.
I agree with you that it's an interesting, it's a more accurate analogy than a lot of times you compare Alaska to countries, and that's really not right. But Alberta is in a pretty analogous situation in a lot of ways, even though the structure is different, and they've got lower wellheads. I mean, they still have the same kind of questions as one that Alaska does. It'd be interesting to see what they're doing and what the, you know, what effect it's had on the industry and exploration.
I think what you come out with in the end, if you just look at shares, I suppose, with the province, the share is probably higher than the state, but a little bit further behind, because the dollar is much less because of prices.
Right.
One of the disputes between Alberta and the federal government is what their respective shares could be. One of the disputes of the industry with both governments is what the industry share should be. I would guess, let me take a stab at it, and we'll correct ourselves if I'm wrong. I shouldn't say what your industry share is, because most of the calculations which are made here in Alaska are ad hominem Trudeau Bay. If the producer's share at Trudeau under existing tax regime, I suppose works out to something in the order of 20%. I would suspect that the average industry share in Alberta comes out to something close to that. But you see, there's a big difference. When you talk about crude oil share being 20%, we're talking about probably the most prolific and most profitable, taxes aside, discovery and development that's ever been made in the oil industry in North America. If you talk about Alberta 20%, you're talking about across the board with all kinds of operations. So I would caution on the interpretation of it. But my guess is that the producer's share in Alberta on oil operations is probably not much different from the crude oil share.
Capital investment per share per barrel would be quite different.
You can do a further question?
Yeah, I do. Not exactly on this subject, but nobody else has any on that. Do you have any predictions about any potential oil shocks that might be coming? And I just wonder, you know, in your business, when you get around with people in the same field, what do you guys talk about? Where's the action? And what, you know, a lot of times we find out things that we...
How long do we have to wait before the next shoe, the other shoe drops?
Yeah, right.
Let me give you probabilities, okay? The probability of a major explosion in the Middle East within 24 hours ought not to be higher than 10%. The probability of a major political upheaval in the Middle East within the next 3 years is probably something like 65%. And this is not an accident. The Middle East has always been a politically unstable area as far back in history. The fact that oil has been discovered there doesn't tend to make it more secure, doesn't take to make it more placid. It exacerbates all of the political problems in the Middle East. And the odds of something happening have to be very, very considerable. So I have high confidence that nothing going to happen in the next 24 hours. But that's about as far as even the political arena now between Iraq and Iran, which is in the process of conflagration. What are the odds that something can happen there? The odds of peace are infinitesimally small. The odds of a truce are much better. A lot of reasons. The odds of a stand down in hostilities without anything political being resolved may be even better. But when you're finished saying all of that, how long would you expect that whatever it is going to last, given the inherent conflict of interest between the two countries for years and years, and now exacerbated by the hostilities?
Mr. Chairman, yeah. It's a, maybe a little bit out of your line, so if you don't want to comment on it, it's fine with me, but is the change in administration having any obvious effect on, you know, they have, the State Department have a whole different attitude or anything in regards to the Middle East that's going to change something that's going to have an effect on us?
Well, I think so far, I think there must have been. In legal terms, this is the worst kind of obiter dictum, what I'm saying, for heaven's sakes. But in the change in administration must have had some psychological impact in the Middle East. If nothing else, the Saudi Arabs, who are inevitably linked to us from dependent upon us, not because after the debacle with Iran they have that much confidence in the United States, but if they don't, to whom else can they turn anyway? In terms of their desire for this for stability in the Middle East, there's nobody else that they can really look to as having any input whatsoever other than the United States. And I suspect that just the statements coming out of the administration in terms of willingness to consider more favorably the request for arms and so on. I don't know whether this is conducive to stability in the Middle East or not. I wouldn't make a judgment about it, but it must have had a psychological impact on the Saudi Arabia. I don't think you see.
And one other question. I don't know exactly what the Department of Revenue is estimating in terms of the increase in the price of oil over the next 18 months, which is of our concern, because our budget cycle is, we're predicting revenues for FY82, which is the next 18 months. Do you have any, and you've said that the general trend for oil prices is upwards, which I don't think anybody's really amazed at here, but do you have any feeling about over the next 18 months what kind of increases we're going to see? I was wondering, I'd like to hear your view. Yeah. On that. I don't know, what are you estimating? You know, is anybody here that knows that? Milt, do you know what they're estimating?
Well, I've seen some figures just recently, but I'm not at all sure that these are basic to the Revenue Department's estimates. Let me just give you our view. We think that the dollar price for the mainstream of world crudes is going to be in a rising trend over the next 18 months. Now, what do you mean by the price of the mainstream of crudes? Let me break it up into three parts. You've got about 10 million barrels a day of Arab crude moving at $32 a barrel. You've got the bulk of everything else in the Middle East moving around $35, $36 a barrel. And you've got the high-value crudes, like the African crude, moving somewhere around $40 a barrel. Now, if you take this $35, $36 in between, that's what's going to be going up over the next 18 years. I think the Saudi Arabs will be producing less than their 10 million barrels a day and will be selling it at a higher price than 32. They're going to move up towards the 36, and as the 36 goes to 37, 38, they're going to say, they're going along with it is what's going to make it possible. I think there's going to be very, very little upward movement on the price of the high price crude. They're going to be under pressure as these surpluses
develop. Are they high price because of better oil? Or?
No.
Or because of the price
they traditionally have been high priced because it's better oil closer to world markets, lower transportation costs. But by how much they are higher priced depends upon whether there are shortages or not.
Yeah.
And the real high price, the premiums that they get, was because the world was in the course of either actual shortages or uncertain availability, and so they could get the price. Now, what that means is that the mainstream of Alaskan crude moving to lower 48 markets should be in competition with and value in accordance with the mainstream of our foreign imports, which in terms of average price would probably be going up somewhat. Now, when I say it's going up in dollar price, how much? I don't think that OPEC, which is in the business of supporting their own prices precisely when they are world oil surpluses, that's their business, that's what they're all about, that's why they created themselves, are going to let the dollar price go up any less than what they think is the inflation rate. What the inflation rate is what they think it is. not what it actually is, and that's going to be, what, 10% per year? And I think probably they would like to have at least some increase in real prices, certainly no decline in real prices. So I think they were talking about increases in the average price of food at the rate of something like 10-12% a year over the next 2-3 years, while there is surplus in world market. Give me one of these crises that won't come tomorrow, but 48 hours is more probable than 24 hours, and all bets are off, because you can have tremendous upward pressure in the world.
Further question, Mr. Lee. Mr. Malone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going back on some items you brought up, in the province of Alberta there, they have federal price controls. Does that apply to new oil there, or just old oil?
Yes.
It does.
Yes, oil. There's no distinction between old and new oil, except by the province itself and its royalty rate.
And they're pegged down around $18 a barrel or less Canadian. To what extent has that depressed exploration and development fields in Alberta or in Canada?
Well, I don't know to what extent the price itself has discouraged exploration, but the tax and constitutional dispute between the province and the federal government has brought exploration virtually to a halt in the province of Alberta. Now, that's fairly recent. That came to a head as of the late fall of 1980 and has not yet been resolved. And the uncertainty as to how it's going to be resolved or when it's going to be resolved has certainly led to an abrupt decline in actual exploratory drilling.
What is the issue of uncertainty there?
Well, the federal government is arguing that the province of Alaska is taking a considerably higher share at the expense of the federal government.
Alberta.
And that the federal government has energy responsibilities that require funding. And the only way the federal government can exercise its responsibilities for the nation as a whole in this energy field is to increase their revenue. And what they're proposing is a modest, if you talk about shares, what they're proposing is a modest decline in Alberta's share and a significant decline in the industry share. But of course, the other question is not just the shares, but what is the size of the pie which is going to be shared, and that depends on what they're willing to do on the wellhead price. And in effect, what they're saying is that we are protecting the consumer share, because obviously the consumer gets a share insofar there is price control. And what the industry and what the province feels is that the consumer share is being protected a little too assiduously, and that for the consumers to feel that they can continue to get oil and gas at these kinds of prices when the replacement cost or the alternative is so high. I should say that the issue became a crisis as of March 1st of this year, when Alberta, in retaliation, reduced their authorized level of production in Alberta, which they can do constitutionally, by 60,000 barrels a day, in fact by 100,000 barrels a day, because it depends on what level, but authorized 60,000 barrels a day, and progressively will raise the cutbacks in production to 180,000 barrels a day, forcing the federal government to replace the lost domestic...